Welcome to Community Alert. Not if, but when. Positive preparation for disaster with Ted Adams and Mike Williams. Keeping you informed on how to get ready and be prepared. Tuesdays at 11 a.m. and 9 p.m. and Saturdays at 1 p.m. on AM 1290, the Santa Barbara News Press radio station.
Hey folks, welcome to the show. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Michael Williams. And today we're talking with Chief Ronnie Coleman, California State Fire Marshal retired and head of the National Fire Heritage Center. And Mike, it's up to you.
Well, Chief, welcome to the show. We got a couple of quick announcements here. First, Santa Barbara County Fire Safe Council meeting this Thursday, October 16th, 9 a.m. at Santa Barbara Red Cross, 2707 State Street. This month's agenda will be a roundtable discussion on what's going on in our various neighborhoods, fire agency, and community organization projects. If you're interested in what's going on with fire mitigation here locally, this is the meeting to go to Thursday, October 16th, 9 a.m., Santa Barbara County Red Cross, 2707. And again, that's Santa Barbara County Fire Safe Council. And that's the only announcement in the hopper, so let's jump into today's discussion. Chief, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
Well, last week we got in a discussion with Santa Barbara County Fires Cause and Origin Investigator, Howard Orr, and Paul Cashman with State Farm Insurance, and we were getting into the question of what came first, the insurance or the fire suppression business. And so I said I knew just the guy to ask. And so welcome to the show. Let's kind of get into the history of firefighting, which actually takes us all the way back to Emperor Augustus.
Oh, that's true. As a matter of fact, when we talk about the history of fire services, there are multiple histories, and they go back a couple of thousand years. Unfortunately, a lot of people have forgotten some of the sequence of events and have no idea of when certain things started and when certain things stopped. But the fact of the matter is that the original reason for fire protection was the protection of the city of Rome.
Now, the building codes kind of started back in that time also, did they not?
Well, when we talk about codes, that all started with a guy named Hammurabi. Yeah, who wrote a bunch of rules about his kingdom back in the early days. And amongst Hammurabi's rules was if an architect built a building and the building fell down and killed somebody, then they went and killed the architect. pretty severe consequences of failure, you might say. But
not a bad idea, actually.
Well, I can't get a single architect to agree to that one. Not one.
So as we move forward into the American Fire Service, we really have to kind of turn to Europe, do we not?
Well, let me not get away from Rome quite so fast, because what we have to remember is that fire protection for many, many years, literally decades, was not considered to be a function of society. It was a function of you as a human being. You tried to protect your own home against the ravages of fire, and if you had a problem, it was your problem. It wasn't the community's problem. And not until we started having major cities development like Paris and London and Rome did fire protection become a social function or a cultural function of society. The very first fire brigades were actually sections of the Roman army. And they came about, they were called the Vigiles, V-I-G-I-L-E-S. The Vigiles meant vigilance. And they would patrol the streets at night, and they had a very semi-military-type organizational structure. They had a chief who rode a horse and wore white, and they had what they refer to as different types of firefighters. It was a hook man, a water man, it was a ladder man, you know, et cetera. And the original construct of the fire service, as we know it today, actually came out of that Roman fire brigade. As they developed it, they put these brigades in different parts of the world. Unfortunately, with the decline of the Roman Empire, some of that stuff kind of fell apart during the Dark Ages, and then it had to be resurrected again, and that's where I think we need to go back and look at Europe, because it was during the Renaissance that fire protection kind of came back to the front row of public concern.
Now, what was driving it at that point? Did they have some major fires that woke folks up? Because folks tend to not do anything until after the fact.
You're right on. There were lots of significant fires. I have an inventory, and you can also find it on the web by just typing in the word, you know, historical fires. There was a series of fires around the world that destroyed major buildings. and destroyed major components of cities, or conflagrations of great significance. And as a result of that, communities started coming up with different ideas about how to control their losses. And fire insurance happened to be one of them. If you go back far enough, you'll find out that in many fire brigades in many communities were actually organized by the insurance companies. And they had a way of identifying the places they protected with a thing called a fire mark. A fire mark was a pewter device that you used to screw on the outside of your house that had a symbol on it. And if your house caught on fire, the various volunteer brigades would run over to your house and look at the symbol on your door or on the side of your house, and then they would decide whether they're going to put your fire out or not. Because fire marks were basically the names of fire insurance companies.
Mm-hmm. Now, that carried over into the United States hundreds of years later, correct?
Well, it actually evolved because of the fact that this occurred in France and Germany and Denmark and England. And these were the primary colonies, of course, that populated the United States of America before it was called the United States. It was the colonies. And when many of the communities that started developing all the way back into the 1600s, one of the very first things that occurred when they populated the colonies in the United States was the development of some kind of a volunteer fire brigade, because nothing could be more devastating than a fire to a colony. A fire in the middle of the winter was a death sentence, because if you lost your home and you lost your barn, you lost your way of protecting yourself. So the idea of insurance companies being organized was popularized by a person that everybody ought to recognize, Benjamin Franklin. In about 1736 or thereabouts, he started organizing different people to talk about fire protection. And he was involved in the creation of some fire insurance companies, and those fire insurance companies supported the local volunteers, yada, 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 and things started changing in this country. You have to remember that the colonies in the United States, which it wasn't the United States at the time, but it was North America is the best phrase I should use, the colonies in North America all were based upon European context. There were many communities that were sponsored by the Brits. There were many communities that were French. There were some that were German. And so in each one of those cases, they patterned their fire protection after their European counterpart.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting, as I doing a little reading on my own here in advance of the show, first recorded major fire in what they recalled as the New World was actually 1608.
Yep.
And by 1666, there was the Great Fire of London.
Yes.
Which I guess at today's standards would have been called the Baker Fire or the Baker Shop Fire.
Yep.
But in between that, fire prevention kicked in. And it's curious to me that fire prevention actually led fire suppression. People were more interested in preventing it from happening in the first place.
That's a very specific observation. A lot of people have lost track of the fact that some of the very first rules that applied to the colonies in this country all had to do with fire prevention. One I thought was particularly humorous was they said they outlawed making candles indoors. And I think that's particularly funny, because if you've ever tried to make a candle, it involves melting wax to the temperature which is likely to ignite. So it made a lot of sense that you prohibited candle making. But the one that I thought was particularly funny was the fact that they outlawed wooden chimneys. And I thought, what in the heck would you want to make your chimney out of wood for? But if you go back to even the early days in the 1600s, there were laws about the type of roof you could put on a building, the type of business that you could engage in. And all of that preceded the actual operational side of firefighting.
Well, with that, we're up to our first break, visiting today with former California State Fire Marshal Ronnie Coleman and president of National Fire Heritage Center on Community Alert with Ted Adams, Mike Williams, Mr. Salzer working the board for us on Community Alert, KZSB AM 1290 or Santa Barbara News Press Radio. We'll be right back.
Hey, Hey, folks, welcome back to Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams. Today, we have the pleasure of visiting with Chief Ronnie Coleman, who's California State Fire Marshal, retired, and the president of the National Fire Heritage Center. And we're talking about the history of fire, and I'm going to bring it forward from revolutionary times, I guess, to where we are.
Well, Chief, going through my little history book here, I see in 1631, the city of Boston banned thatched roofs. We were talking about that earlier. But it wasn't until 1653 they bought their first fire apparatus, and it wasn't until 1678 they actually tried to think about how they're going to staff it with any degree of organization. And it wasn't until Benjamin Franklin had actually got that figured out in the 1735. That's a lot of history there in 100 years.
Well, that 100 years was full of a lot of other types of activities that went on also. You have to realize the New World was the New World. And everything that went on in this country was a manifestation of technology that was brought over here from the Old World. I always kind of characterize the early era of the fire service as being one of being very concerned about survival. Communities did a lot of things so they could survive. They were afraid of Indian attacks in the middle of the night. They were afraid of fires in the middle of the night. So prevention was more important than reaction during that era. Benjamin Franklin came cruising along about 1736, and as you recall by reading anything about Benjamin, he was one of these kind of guys who had a philosophy about damn near everything. And one of his was, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So a lot of people remember that from Poor Richard's Almanac. And so the emphasis originally was on preventing fires in the first place.
Well, it's interesting that some of the techniques that were being used in the 1600s, 1700s were exactly the same as what Augustus was doing 1,000 years prior.
That's what they call them, bucket brigades.
Yeah.
Most of them were bucket brigades and very small hand-operated pumping devices.
Well,
you can actually look at the pumps that were used in the 1700s, and they're not much different than the ones that were used in Europe in the 1400s.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, one of the things that we see is that with the fire brigades and the whole fire philosophy hasn't changed tremendously, or at least is changing back, where the personal responsibility thing is coming into play, of course, in our neighborhood, and people are becoming more responsible themselves rather than depending on others to prepare for fire. And I think that's interesting, made that full circle.
To draw a historical analogy there, is in the early days of the fire service, everybody had to have a certain number of fire buckets at their house.
Mm-hmm.
And those fire buckets had to have your name on it, Williams. Yeah. Coleman or whatever, and whenever they'd have a fire, the fire watches would run up and down the street and say, throw down your buckets, and everybody would throw their individual buckets out into the street, and then all able-bodied males were expected to then go down and pick up the buckets, go to the water source, and form a bucket brigade. So initially fire protection was the community, and the community was fire protection.
Interesting.
And that kind of has carried all the way over to today when we look at the fact that a lot of this country, at least 70-75% of it, is still protected with volunteer fire service, that in many states, California being one of them, there's no constitutional requirement for government to provide fire service unless they decide they want to. So that's a tradition that's come a long way.
Well, it's a tradition that's been modified over time. I think if you look at the 1700s, no question about it, that was the era of the origin of the volunteer fire service in this country. But as you move forward through time, let's do a little leapfrog here up to about 1830, 1840, just prior to the Civil War, is when we started having fairly significant size cities. New York City, Philadelphia, Boston, they were concentrations of communities that could no longer rely on arbitrary fire protection. They started organizing themselves and forming fire brigades and volunteer fire companies and so on and so forth. And then that evolved into the 1850s, where technology started taking a place. Probably one of the most revolutionary things that changed the nature of firefighting was the creation of the steam fire pumper. And that occurred in about the 1850s. And one of the reasons it occurred was to get rid of the volunteer firefighters. The technology was brought into the fire service because the volunteers had quite a reputation for fighting amongst themselves when they would go to fires. And so if you go back to the city of Cincinnati, 1851, they brought a piece of equipment called Uncle Joe Ross. That was the name of a steamer. And what's interesting to me today, personally, is if you look at the plate on the side of a steamer, it says this steamer will produce 1,250 gallons per minute at 100 PSI at 10-foot lift. That's the same standard for a Class A pumper today.
You know, a great book on steam engines, Those Magnificent Old Steam Fire Engines by Fred Conway. I also did a book called Chemical Fire Engines, which kind of parallels the same thing with the steamers, available still on the Internet through Amazon.com. Great book if you're interested in the history of the fire service as it started to become more mechanical.
That's a classic example. However, during that same time era, there was still people in the fire community who didn't necessarily give up on the idea of fire prevention. One person I like to constantly remind people of was Chief John Damrell. John was the chief of the Boston Fire Department in the 1870s, and he came into the forefront by suggesting that there ought to be a fire code and a building code in his community, and he was rewarded by being fired.
Huh. Not unlike today's chiefs.
Well, and what's funny is they had a fire, and there was actually a TV series, or it was a TV movie made called Damrell's Fire, in which they had all the steam apparatus, but unfortunately all the horses were sick that day, and they had to pull the steamers to the scene with manpower. And I mean, literally manpower. It took 40, 50 guys to be able to tow a couple of ton steamer down the streets.
Well, that's an interesting comment about, well, let's go back briefly. One of the comments you talked about was throwing down your buckets.
Yeah.
That comes from the European in Europe when they would have stations that people had to report to, hence the red light that we still see today on the fire stations.
Well, that was referred to, that light you're referring to was on the front of the building to let people know that this is the place you could go to get help. And it was also a lantern that quite frequently the fire service or the volunteer firefighters would grab that torch and they would run through the street towards the fire preceding any of the volunteers. And that preceded red lights and sirens on fire apparatus. Hmm. Almost all technologies, Mike, is a stage of continuous evolution. The fire service talks a lot about being 300 years of tradition unhampered by progress, but that's entirely a misstatement because we're 300 years of progress that's shaped by tradition. We're not using steamers to fight fires anymore, but we still use the mindset of putting a lot of water on a fire when it's needed.
And yet, when we saw the transition with steamers towards gas and diesel, and the historical fire service of the day concerned that the trucks wouldn't start, and that created kind of a hybrid vehicle where the steamers were actually put on trucks versus being pulled by horses, but there were still those who thought the horse was more reliable than the vehicles. Those must have been interesting times.
They always were. The more you read the original literature of the history of the fire service that was written during the time it actually occurred as opposed to being done retrospectively, you'll find out that the fire service has three attitudes towards technology. Attitude number one is, it won't work. Attitude number two is, it works, but I don't like it. Attitude number three is, well, how did we get along without this before?
That's a little bit after the fact. So coming up to our next break, visiting today with former California State Fire Marshal Ronnie J. Coleman, also the president of National Fire Heritage Center out of Emmitsburg, on Community Alert with Ted Adams, Mike Williams. Not It But Win, Positive Preparation for Disaster on KZSB AM 1290, live at thenewspress.com. We'll be right back.
Hey, folks, welcome back to the show. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams, and today we're visiting with Chief Ronnie Coleman for the California State Fire Marshal, retired, and the president of the National Fire Heritage Center, talking about the history of fire throughout the world and how it leads up to today's firefighting.
Well, Chief, walking down the history road here, there were several key individuals that sort of laid the foundation, Franklin obviously being one of them, but there were others that kind of started the foundation in which the NFPA and other organizations, the insurance industry and what have you, have been built. Let's look at that for a few minutes.
Well, I think what we have to do is not only look at those individuals, but look at the context. Remember the Civil War, because the Civil War had a profound impact on the fire service. A lot of people don't realize that during the Civil War, many volunteer firefighters left their position as a volunteer firefighter to become a soldier, and many of them were killed in the battles. And quite frankly, the volunteer fire service was decimated during the Civil War, resulting in some ideas that maybe we need to be more technologically intensive, and that matched up with the industrialization of this country. The steam fire apparatus was brought in the 1850s, but it was never really popular until about 1860s and 1870s. And there were individuals who took advantage of that. I mentioned earlier a guy named John Damrell. John was an interesting individual in that he was not only a fire chief, but he was a visionary and in the area of building codes. And he spent a lot of his time trying to get codes and standards created. And about that time was when we also created a technology that it has had a significant effect on the fire service, and that's sprinkler systems. The National Fire Protection Association, which most everybody knows of today, probably got its primary start with the creation of NFPA-1. And NFPA-1 was a sprinkler standard. That resulted in a lot of our organizations coming into reality in the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s. That's when the International Association of Fire Chiefs was created. The fire department started going full-time in the metropolitan areas, which resulted in the IAFF being created. The National Fire Protection Association and all of those organizations got their incentive in response to the industrialization of this country.
Now, when we look at the sprinkler, that later became NFPA 13 and 13D, being the residential sprinkler requirements.
Don't forget 13R, that's the apartment houses.
Well, and then we've got hospitals and what have you. But sprinklers are an intricate part of fire suppression and fire prevention, public safety side of it. And yet it's been one of the more adversarial issues for well over 150 years. Why is that?
Well, unfortunately, sprinklers don't always have the best, somebody who is actually telling their story at the local level, because most sprinkler ordinances really don't have any impact on a national basis. They have an impact on a local level, and that includes sprinkling major risks at one time was an economic issue. I'll share a little story with you is that first sprinklers that were put in the 1850s and 1860s were all put in major industrial complexes. So they had to do with mills on the East Coast. They had to do with big, big buildings. And as we've gone over a period of time, different types of occupancies have come under the umbrella of the sprinklers. And, of course, that creates special interest groups that kind of say, well, you know, why us and why now and all this other stuff. However, there's no question, and most people's minds, that sprinkler systems are the first line of defense when it comes to fire prevention.
Well, let's move forward from there, because then it came the Gainwell alarm systems. When did they start hitting the streets, fire alarms and the Gainwell systems?
Well, about the same time in the late 1800s. That was those Gainwell boxes were invented by a guy named Dr. Channing. He was a medical doctor. And the alarm systems were put in primarily to serve as the eyes of the fire service, because remember, in those days, we didn't have a telephonic system. So the original fire alarm boxes were placed on intersections that were within sight of specific risks so that the fire department could be notified. Then, that expanded and expanded. I was joking earlier when I told you about the three stages of technology. You have to remember one thing about the history of the fire service, and that is that fire services change technologies about every 40 years. And I can almost give you the time frame for every one of those technological shifts. And it has to do with what's going on in society, because the fire service uses tools from society. Let's go back to something you kind of joked about earlier about the guys being upset about the loss of horses. When horses were used to pull steam fire apparatus and they were relied on 100% for transportation, the minute that somebody suggested that you could get rid of the horses and replace them by a gasoline engine, it was an instant reaction and rejection. Because the guys that were using the horses knew what the horses were capable of doing, and their attitude was they can't be replaced. However, as soon as we replaced them, 20 years later, all the horses were gone. It took about 25 to 30 years from the day motorized apparatus was introduced for steam. In fact, in my own town of Sacramento, where I live now, they still had truck companies in service being pulled by horses until the 1930s.
We know the steamer was also the birth of the fire station, was it not?
Well, I wouldn't call it the birth of the fire station. I'd say that the steamer, because there were fire stations that existed long before that, but I think what the purpose of the steamer was, it probably started establishing the standard for which people in the community expected the fire department to respond. I teach a class, or used to teach a class, on standards of cover, which has to do with how far and how fast you can get to the scene of a fire. And what was really funny is the original standard for response time in this country was based on how far can a team of horses gallop in 5 minutes.
Well, it's Dave Hubert with the CSFA Steamer Team talks a lot about the history of the steamers and the fire stations themselves. Christmas Major, a book that he wrote, talks about it, because you had to keep a fire going at all times in the steamer.
That's correct.
You had to keep the horses dry and sheltered. It was quite a process to be able to respond. And you needed a building to do all that in, so it was out of the elements.
Well, that's true, but a lot of those were converted from earlier fire stations, which were more built for social settings. I can go take you to fire stations around the country that if you entered them, you would almost think you were going into like a Masonic hall or something, because they had big rooms for gathering around the table. They had kitchens in them so they could prepare meals, et cetera. Interesting phenomenon. I can show you fire stations today that still have steel rails in the apparatus floor where the steel wheels that were on a steamer were allowed to run back and forth so they wouldn't crush the bricks. And so you're right about the idea of technology having certain limitations. Kind of funny, if you do any studying of steam fire apparatus, you'll find out that the horses were remarkable. The horses were sometimes so well trained that if they got an incident and the bells would ring, if the firemen didn't move fast enough, they'd leave without them.
Well, the issue of having horses also brings us to the issue of the Dalmatian, which is a question that comes up frequently, is the birth of the Dalmatian and where that came from. And I think people would be surprised as to what the Dalmatian's real job was.
Well, the Dalmatian comes from a region of the world called Dalmatia that basically used those dogs as what we refer to as coach dogs. They are companions to the horse. Horses are very sociable animals. They like to be around something or somebody. And the Dalmatians were brought in basically as a support for the horse. They would run behind the coach or in front of the coach to get other animals out of the way and, you know, and to kind of provide an avant-garde type of an approach. If you go back far enough in the history, you'll find that the type of horses that were used, most of them were big-boned, big-breed horses like Percherons and that type of horse. The Dalmatian was really a companion to the horse, not the companion of the firefighter.
Interesting.
Well, they also provided a little bit of security to keep people from stealing things off unattended equipment,
too. That's correct.
And speaking of unattended, Rob Selzer sitting in for Richard Dugan today on the board, reminding us it's time for our next break. Ted Adams, Mike Williams on Community Alert. Not it, but win. Positive preparation for disaster on KZSB AM 1290 or Santa Barbara News Press Radio, live on the internet at newspress.com. We'll be right back.
Hey, folks, welcome back to Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams. And today we're visiting with Chief Ronnie Coleman, California State Fire Marshal, retired, and the head of the National Fire Heritage Association.
Mike. So we left off around the 1930s, give or take, with the transition coming out of the steam era into diesel and gasoline fire engines and the advancement of technology up to that point. Where'd it go from there, Chief?
Well, it continues to go and grow in many different ways. Mike, the reason I'm such an avid historian personally is the fact that at any given point in time, whatever we're doing to solve America's fire problem is the best way to do things. But at any given point in time, everything changes. Let me just use one technology. How about the idea of notification of a fire? You can go back to a lot of old... Hang on a second. Apparently my wife's phone's ringing. I apologize. Issue is that if you go back to the early days, the only way that the fire department could be notified is somebody had to go tell them they had a fire. There were fire watch things that were put up in the communities where people were sitting in towers. There were people who, back in the early days of 1600s, 1700s, they have fire watchmen who used to walk the streets at night, etc. Now compare that to today, where we've got 800 megahertz radios, we've got cell phones that have GPS installed on them, we've got fire alarm systems that talk to the dispatch center, et cetera, et cetera. Every tool and technology in our repertoire of firefighting has its origins in some primitive technology that was state-of-the-art for a certain period of time. Every single one of them, apparatus, tools and equipment, protective clothing. And so when you study history, you get this feeling of, well, why did we do it in the first place? And how can we make it better? The fire service will continue to evolve. It'll never stay the same.
Well, you mentioned protective clothing. That is an area that's really expanded, say, over the last 25, 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
So the technology is sometimes a little slow to catch up, but it's being driven by different forces that we don't necessarily have direct control over.
I think one of the greatest things that's happening today from a historical point of view is the research work being done by Dan Madrakowski at the National Institute of Standards and Technology. Dan and the UL people have been doing a fantastic job of putting science behind a lot of these things. As a historian, I'm always excited to find out a new fact, but probably more excited sometimes to find out why that fact came into existence. And I'll give you a classic example of the what I'm really talking about here. Is I once visited a building museum in England where they actually had a demonstration of what they called daub and wattle, which was a way of building fire-resistive construction into buildings by plastering things with mud and clay and things of that nature. And nowadays, you've got what they refer to as drywall that does the same stuff. But there's science behind all this, and the more science we bring to bear, the more the history will change in the direction of success.
When we look at critical fires that have occurred, say, over the last 200 years, which are the ones that were most notable for causing change in policies and procedures and maybe operational tactics? What are the big-name fires that we look at?
Oh, boy, I'm sure we've got enough time left to talk about all of them, so I'll just be really brief about it. I call these catastrophic theory of reform fires, and that is that we change once there's a serious enough fire that we kill enough people that everybody gets upset about it. And I'll name a couple. The Iroquois Theater fire, which occurred in a theater that resulted in massive changes to public assembly. Coconut Grove fire, which had occurred in Boston, that resulted in huge changes in the fire codes regarding exiting requirements. For example, you don't take for granted the fact that all the doors in public assembly swing out. In the Coconut Grove fire, they swung in. And you realize what happens when you've got 400 people trying to leave a building when the door swings in? They pile up behind the door and they die.
Well, Coconut Grove killed 492 people in 1942. That's a sizable event.
Yes, it was. And we call those catastrophic theory of reform fires. I can go back to the Beverly Hills Supper Club fire. One of our more recent ones had to do with what it was in Worcester. It was the nightclub fire that killed a bunch of young music aficionados. But I can also go back to the days of the Roman Empire and find fires that killed hundreds of people then, too. So what we're constantly being faced with historically is how to create a better community that's more fire safe, and then simultaneously how to create a response system that will cope with the biggest disaster that you face. And both of those are historical threads that have to be followed. They're not necessarily the same.
Well, the fire insurance business transcends through all of this, too, does it not?
Oh, yeah. You know, I mentioned earlier, back in the early days, we had fire marks we used to put on the outside of buildings. We don't do that anymore, but I can tell you right now that the insurance industry has a role to play in fire safety in this country, because they're the ones who are insuring the risk that's in the community. And they have many programs, including things like fire safe councils that they support and grant programs that they support local fire departments. I don't think that the marriage is as good between the insurance industry today as it was 300 years ago, but I still think it exists.
How much of today's fire departments respond to the pressures of the insurance industry, or is it the other way around?
I don't think that the fire service today is driven particularly by the interest of the insurance industry, for the very simple reason that insurance industry is predominantly concerned about property loss, and the average fire department today is spending 70 to 80% of their time on emergency medical aids. There is a nexus. It's called the ISO grading schedule, and as a student of the past, I actually have a copy of every one of their grading schedules. And since it was created in Portland, Maine, back in at the turn of the century, there's been huge changes in the ISO's perspective of property loss, and they're still a role player, but I don't think many fire departments are organized based on insurance needs.
Now, we've been talking primarily about municipal fire service. There's another fire service out there, which is the Wildland World. Is the history somewhat the same, or are they coming from a different perspective?
Well, their history basically starts about 1910.
Right.
That was called the Year of the Fires. And up until 1910, a wildland fire was considered a natural phenomena. They occurred on the landscape, and everybody kind of stood around and watched them, but nobody fought them. In 1910, we had a huge, significant change because it was a devastating year. It was the creation of the United States Forest Service. Teddy Roosevelt was president, and he had a guy by the name of Pinchot, who was an environmentalist, and said, "We got to blot out these fires in the wildland." And so that their history, wildland fire control, I would characterize as starting about 1910. They're just a little over 100 years old.
Well, with that, we're coming up to our next break. Ted Adams, Mike Williams, Mr. Seltzer on the board for us today, sitting in for Richard Dugan on Community Alert, Not If But When, Positive Preparation for Disaster. KZSB AM 1290, your Santa Barbara News Press Radio, live on the internet at newspress.com. We'll be back in just a moment.
Folks, welcome to the last segment of the show. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams, and we've been visiting today with Chief Ronnie Coleman, California State Fire Marshal, retired, and president of the National Fire Heritage Center.
Well, Chief, let's kind of do a summary here of our last 300-plus years of American fire service.
I'd be happy to do that. I kind of like to use a quote from a very famous philosopher, though, before I do that. And it was a guy named George Santayana who once said that people who can't remember history are doomed to repeat it.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is that the history of the American Fire Service has many, many chapters. And each one of those chapters was kind of like a building block that has taken us from some relatively primitive ways of fighting fire, i.e. bucket brigades, all the way up to the point we are today with automatic fire protection systems and so forth. And it reminds me of something I've become somewhat of a student of, and that's the idea of the good old days. I started in the fire service in 1960, and I worked with guys who had literally been in fire stations in the 1920s and 1930s. And to them, that was the good old days. Well, to me, the 60s were the good old days. And the way I look at it is, anybody who is a participant in the fire discipline, the good old days is when they start their career and when they finish it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you stand back and look at this, it's a journey. It's a journey of challenges. It's a journey of competency. It's a journey of technology, et cetera. And studying the history of the fire service doesn't make you want to go back to the good old days. Instead, it gives you an opportunity to start planning for the better new days. That's my philosophy of studying history, is it's not about reverence of the past as much as it's respect.
Well, we certainly have seen that the history of fire prevention has worked when we look at the total number of fires that most municipal agencies respond to today, and minuscule compared to their EMS assignments. So fire prevention is working, and we don't have the big major fires that we used to have in the municipal environment for the most part. So our suppression techniques and the technology that goes with it also seems to be working for us.
Well, but that doesn't mean our challenges have gone away, because we still have the urban wildland interface problem, which we have not solved yet. We still have the single-family dwelling fire, which we have not solved yet. I would agree with your assessment. We don't get as many fires as we used to, but we still get catastrophic fires. And if we look at them from a historical point of view, I think everybody kind of recognizes the fact that major fires are often a result of just not paying attention to a problem until it becomes serious. And that's one of our historical challenges.
Well, you know, the U.S. Fire Administration is putting out almost daily notices of civilian fatalities from fires. So it's still an issue that needs to be addressed.
Most dangerous building that anybody can live in is their own home.
Mm-hmm.
Well, with that thought, let's move in quickly into the National Fire Heritage Center. What are you doing, and how is history playing into your objectives at the center?
Well, thank you for giving me that opportunity. The National Fire Heritage Center is an organization that has as its mission the preservation of the perishable. We all know that the firefighters are big collectors. We collect helmets and hoses and nozzles and all this other stuff, which is all the hardware. But the reality is that it's people and their memories and their institutional contributions and so forth that are equally important. So the National Fire Heritage Center has been established to collect the institutional memory of people who have served. Just this morning, we lost another tremendous influence leader in the fire service. Dr. John Bryan just passed away, who is one of the leaders of fire protection engineering discipline back in the University of Maryland. And what we're attempting to do is to collect the works and the contributions of these types of individuals, catalog it so that it can be retrieved, and then make it available for people so that they can realize that sometimes the facts that support changes are developed by people, not by machines. That's our mission. We have a museum that's located about a half a mile away from the National Fire Academy on Seton Boulevard in Emmitsburg, Maryland. We're a membership organization in that we encourage people to join with us. We are also an archivist of people's careers and lives. We've done about a half a dozen exhibits over the last year of people such as Bob Bearclaw and Hal Bruno and Jan Grattan and people of that nature. And we're looking forward to continuing to establish a place where people can have a repository of information from the past.
How can people get more involved with the Heritage Center?
Several ways. One is by joining us as a member. Go on our website. The website is thenfhc.org, and you can download a membership application. Another way is to actually visit the National Fire Heritage Center if you're at the National Fire Academy. We get quite a few students coming down from the U.S. Fire Administration when they're there on campus. And then, of course, last but not least, they could contact, I could leave my phone number here of 916-799-5363.
And with that, we're at the end of the show. Sorry to cut you off, Chief. The news is next on KZSB AM 1290. We'll see you next week.
Community Alert,
is produced by the Wildland Residents Association, San Marcos Pass Volunteer Fire Department, with funding provided by a grant from the Cooperative Fire Program of the U.S. Forest Service, Department of Agriculture, Pacific Southwest Region, through the California Fire Safe Council, with additional funding provided by the Fire Services Training Institute. The views and conclusions contained in this program are those of the hosts and guests and should not be interpreted as representing the opinions or policies of the California Fire Safe Council, U.S. Forest Service, the U.S. government, or this station. Any mention of trade names or commercial products does not constitute their endorsement by the California Fire Safe Council or the U.S. government. Commercial use or rebroadcast is prohibited. For further information, call 805-964-7194 or visit wildlandresidents.org. Technical assistance provided by Richard Dugan, Jim Williams, and Mark A. Ward. The WRA and this station are equal opportunity providers.